From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, novelist Michael Ondaatje. His novel, The English Patient, about four people stranded in an Italian villa after World War II, won the coveted Booker Prize. Ondaatje grew up in Sri Lanka in an eccentric family who taught him to embellish a good story. Also, like father, like son, we talk with comic writer and actor Chris Elliott. His father, Bob Elliott, was one half of the radio comedy team Bob and Ray. Chris Elliott is starring in the new movie, Cabin Boy. And world music commentator Milo Miles plays us some dancehall reggae and the debut album of Jamaican-born dancehall reggae star, Shaggy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Clinton administration is penalizing China for shipping millions of Chinese products to the United States through other nations. U.S. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor says the import limits on Chinese textiles and clothing will be cut by 25% to 35% on dozens of product categories. The cuts will take effect January 17th. Cantor estimates the reduction will slice China's export products by as much as $1.2 billion. The death of President Clinton's mother has forced him to cancel his plans to deliver a foreign policy address today in Milwaukee, but Vice President Al Gore stepped in and delivered the speech. Annalise Henzel of member station WUWM reports.
The vice president said the Milwaukee stop was scheduled to outline United States foreign policy before the president heads to Europe Saturday. Mr. Gore assured the audience the administration is supporting Eastern European countries like Poland and the Czech Republic, even though it says it's too early for them to be included in NATO.
We tried running away from the world after World War I. What did it bring us? A depression and another horrible war. But when we helped shape world events after World War II, what did that bring us? Decades of security and prosperity.
Mr. Gore acknowledged some would rather focus on problems at home than abroad, but said the security of Eastern European nations directly affects the security of America. For National Public Radio, I'm Annalise Henzel in Milwaukee.
Former House Speaker Tip O'Neill has died. He was 81. O'Neill died of heart failure last night in a Boston hospital. Former President Ronald Reagan distinguished him as one of the country's most well-known legislators. The Justice Department says it will fine a Colorado parking lot firm that has not complied with the Americans with Disabilities Act. The agency says it's the first time it's invoked civil fines under the new law. Ansel Martinez reports from Denver.
A private citizen filed a complaint with the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division over a year ago. The resident complained that the All Right Parking Company in Denver, that runs more than 100 parking lots around the city, didn't have enough handicapped spaces. After a lengthy investigation, department lawyers agreed. Officials said they tried to negotiate a settlement with All Right Parking, but were unsuccessful. Department lawyers have said they prefer discussion to filing lawsuits when enforcing the public accommodations laws of the Americans with Disabilities Act. But Acting Civil Rights Division head James Turner said, talking always doesn't work, so the department decided to fine the company $20,000 and asked the federal court in Denver to order All Right Parking to provide 400 more handicapped spots at its lots. For National Public Radio, I'm Ansel Martinez in Denver.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 11 points. This is NPR. Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders is calling on smoking parents to stop for the health of their children. Elders cites statistics that say secondhand smoke causes up to 300,000 respiratory infections every year in babies younger than a year and a half. She says as many as 15,000 babies are hospitalized. Elders has opened the campaign at a Washington, D.C. school. The government is proposing changes to protect the scenic Grand Canyon area from a dam upstream that has sent damaging floodwaters into the Colorado River. The Bureau of Reclamation is asking for public comments on the new operating plan for the Glen Canyon Dam. NPR's Barbara Campbell reports.
Environmentalists had protested that the dam sent punishing volumes of water through the valley each day at peak times for power demand, raising the river level as much as 10 feet. The nonprofit Grand Canyon Trust says erosion of area beaches hurts Native Americans who make their livings in the recreation industry. And the group's Washington lobbyist, Julie Gale, says the wildlife has been hurt.
Native animals in the Grand Canyon for migratory birds and for native plants that depends on beach sands was being eradicated just by this daily, twice daily, up and down fluctuation.
The Bureau of Reclamation says the dam has been operating recently at a more even rate, storing power for peak times. The Bureau is proposing to maintain that approach and says it has not caused a power shortage. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
Russian ultranationalist Vladimir Zhirinovsky is angry that President Clinton won't meet with him next week in Moscow. Zhirinovsky is calling the president a coward who ought to stay home and play his saxophone rather than meet with Russian nobodies. The White House has made it clear Mr. Clinton will have nothing to do with Zhirinovsky. The ultranationalist leads the Russian Liberal Democratic Party. That group won broadly in recent Russian elections. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Writer Michael Ondaatje was born in Sri Lanka, went to boarding school in England, and settled in Canada when he was 20. Like Ondaatje himself, his writing is a blend of many cultural influences. He's been writing poetry and novels for 25 years, and his books include a memoir about his extended family in Sri Lanka called Running in the Family. His most recent novel is entitled The English Patient, which won the 1992 Booker Prize, the most prestigious award for literature in the British Commonwealth. It's the story of four survivors in World War II, a nurse, a professional thief turned spy, an East Indian soldier who defuses bombs, and an Englishman who's dying from burns he's received in an airplane crash. They find refuge together in a bombed-out Italian villa, where they begin to reveal stories about their past. The San Francisco Chronicle called the novel sensuous, mysterious, rhapsodic, and Ondaatje's most probing examination yet of the nature of identity. I spoke with Michael Ondaatje earlier today. We began with a reading from the opening page of The English Patient.
Every 4 days she washes his black body, beginning at the destroyed feet. She wets a washcloth and, holding it above his ankles, squeezes the water onto him, looking up as he murmurs, seeing his smile. Above the shins, the burns are worst, beyond purple. Bone. She has nursed him for months, and she knows the body well, the penis sleeping like a seahorse, the thin, tight hips. Hip bones of Christ, she thinks. He is her despairing saint. He lies flat on his back, no pillow, looking up at the foliage painted onto the ceiling, its canopy of branches, and above that, blue sky. She pours calamine in stripes across his chest where he is less burned, where she can touch him. She loves the hollow below the lowest rib, its cliff of skin. Reaching his shoulders, she blows cool air onto his neck, and he mutters, "What?" she asks, coming out of her concentration. He turns his dark face with its gray eyes towards her. She puts a hand into her pocket. She unskins the plum with her teeth, withdraws the stone, and passes the flesh of the fruit into his mouth. He whispers again, dragging the listening heart of the young nurse beside him to wherever his mind is, into that well of memory he kept plunging into during those months before he died.
That's Michael Ondaatje reading from the very beginning of The English Patient. When I first read that, I thought this was a scene about lovers. It was a description of lovers, mm-hmm. not a description of a nurse and her patient.
Mm-hmm.
The very sensuality of it was quite shocking when I realized that she was the patient.
Yeah. Oh, he was the patient.
He was the patient, yeah. Right. She was the nurse.
I think I didn't know at that point. I mean, I knew when I went back to rewrite it, and I wanted to keep a kind of certain possibility of that there. I mean, I think there's kind of, I think any kind of intimacy between four people, you know, different variations of between those four people is a kind of love, you know, and I think that's what happens in this book, even that not involved sexually, there's a kind of tremendous intimacy that happens with these four people. So the kind of physical closeness of that time and place makes it a possibility, certainly.
Well, you seem to have a kind of a sensitivity to the senses. There's a scene a couple pages later on where Hannah is told about the smell of a dog's paw, something that really resonated with me. But you seem to be very keyed into the senses.
Well, I think as a writer, I want to get as close as possible to the people I'm writing about. If I'm going to spend, 4 or 5 years on a book with these people, that my closest company in a way. And it really takes about a year to finally cut out the small talk and get close to these people. And really the first year gets dumped usually. So there is a kind of, hopefully, a great closeness to some noise they hear in the distance or what they're feeling in their fingertips.
Well, these four characters come together because of the war. It's the war that brings them together. Do you identify with their displacement because of the fact that you grew up in Sri Lanka and you lived in England, now live in Canada?
Oh, I think so. I think all four of them, whether they're male or female or from whatever part of the world they're from, I have to identify with them. I think I wasn't really conscious of them all being, as one of them says, international bastards, but that's what happens in this book. They're all people who are plucked out of Toronto and left in Venice, or plucked out of India and put into London or something like that. So, but I think that's the story of our time. That's, you can pick up any group of people in a living room today and 8 out of 10 of them don't come from that area or part of town.
You were born in Sri Lanka in the 1940s, and as I read about your life and your family, came from a rather eccentric, theatrical kind of family. Describe them for us.
Well, it's difficult to describe your mom and dad as eccentrics, really, but, I think when I began that book, I knew very little about my family. I left Sri Lanka at the age of 11, so when I went back in my late 20s, I thought I might try and write a book about my family and where I came from, and discovered this incredible world of really the jazz age, really, in the tropics. They were all extreme. They didn't seem to have too much of a conscience or, some kind of governor in them. So it was a very excessive life of, drinking and partying and dancing and general bad behavior.
And this is the book that you wrote back in 1982 called Running in the Family.
Right. Right. And it's a book that I thought I was doing just for myself, and it was my little family drama. And I didn't think, in fact, I would even get it published. But it was one of the books that really caught on of mine that, I get letters from Utah or something like that, people saying this is just like my family, or someone from New Zealand saying the same thing. It's very odd how if you write about your own place and time and your own local group of people, again, a kind of intimacy, perhaps. It kind of suddenly kind of connects with someone at the other end of the world.
Your family was wealthy for a time.
They were briefly wealthy. They had no money. Then they got money and they spent it all and wasted it. And then we were back to square one.
So when you were little, were they wealthy or in between wealth?
I think I was on the kind of point when they were falling off the precipice, really.
So what kind of a house? What kind of a did your family have servants?
Yeah, but most families had servants. It's quite a kind of normal thing, I think. Mm-hmm. I think what I did have in Sri Lanka was a kind of extended family. My parents broke up, which was no surprise, but it was a kind of buffer zone that because you had so many uncles and aunts, you always wouldn't stay with them so the family. The nuclear family in Sri Lanka is not four people, two parents and two kids. It's about 17 people. So in some senses, it protects you as a child anyway.
Would you say you had a happy childhood?
I had a very happy childhood, actually. I think my older brother and older sisters did not. I think they were a bit... I was kind of blithely being a small child at the time.
Your father was an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of a drinker was he? Do you remember?
Well, he was a kind of binge drinker, I think. He didn't drink for months, and then he'd start drinking, and then he'd be drinking for several days nonstop, and then kind of collapse, and then be back to the genial, loving father. So it was that kind of thing that was happening. So that makes you pretty tense, I think, you know, for many years afterwards. Mm.
Would his personality really change then from when he started to drink?
Yeah, I mean, he was, you know, you really couldn't really communicate with him very much. He was in his own planet then. But, you know, for most of the time, like 90% of the time, he was a great person, mm-hmm. a wonderful person.
You describe the extended family that you had in Sri Lanka. When your parents divorced, what effect did it have on you and your siblings? Did you feel the family break apart, or were there enough other members
well,
to catch everybody?
Again, there were the other members around. You know, I mean, I think it was tough sort of on the older members of the family. But I carried on quite happily, you know, from household to household. So it was easier being there. I wasn't in a kind of, you know, apartment in downtown New York or something.
Your brother Christopher also wrote about your life, all of your lives in Sri Lanka. And he, writing about your book about the family, Running in the Family, he wrote that book is a love letter to the father he, meaning you, never knew, a large and glamorous man away in the distance. But I had been deeply involved with the same man and had to grapple with his demons, which never seemed either romantic or amusing. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting reading that to see how two brothers in the same family can have two very different childhoods.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, my two sisters also have very differing points of view. You know, it's difficult. See, I think what happened was that Christopher, who's about 10 years older than I am, knew my father at a time when, if anything, he was probably more dangerous than tragic. You know, I mean, and then he went to England, and then, in fact, I probably knew him as every brother claims to be the right person. But so I knew him 10 years later when he was a much sadder person, and it seemed much more tragic to me than to Christopher, you know.
You moved to England then when you were about 10 years old. Your mother had already moved there, and then and then you moved to live with her. What was it like for you to make that transition from Sri Lanka to England?
Well, it should have been hell, you know, I mean, and I think it was hell in a way, because, I mean, here I was going from a country where I hadn't worn socks or long trousers, to have to wear both of those things and a tie and a stiff collar and a cap and jacket and...
Sounds very confining.
Very confining. And it wasn't so much the confinement, it was a complete different set of rules one had to learn about how to behave, you know. It's like, so it was quite shocking. And I, in order to kind of survive that, I had to kind of forget the past. You know, it was one of those things where I had to kind of forget that I was from Sri Lanka and forget, you know, what it was like to eat, you know, string hoppers in the morning or something like that instead of poached eggs. So, I think, in a way, Running the Family was a book I wrote as a result of having kind of almost lost that whole childhood time, you know, for almost 20 years.
Were you then trying to be English? I mean, trying desperately to
Not trying to be English, but certainly trying to fit in, trying to be part of a kind of, you know, a normal situation where, you know, I had to kind of learn how, which was a hot water tap and which was a cold water tap, you know. I mean, I'd never seen a hot water tap before. So it was that kind of extreme culture shock.
Did you ever get used to the British food?
I think I had a great passion for tripe for about a year and a half.
But that was it?
And that was it. I never drank a cup of tea after I left Sri Lanka. I thought the tea was terrible. So I'm the non-tea drinker from Sri Lanka.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we have to take a short break. And my guest is Michael Ondaatje. And his latest book is now out in paperback. It's called The English Patient, and it won the Booker Prize last year. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is novelist Michael Ondaatje, and his latest book, out in paperback, is called The English Patient. You moved to Canada, where your brother, your older brother Christopher, was living when you were about 20. What did Canada offer to you?
Canada offered me, I mean, I didn't know at the time when I moved, but it offered me everything. You know, it was wonderful. I think when I left school, whatever it was, 18 or 19 or something like that, in England, I had no idea what I was going to do, like every 9-year-old. And I hadn't really had a chance to kind of... I had a great passion for reading novels and reading English and writing essays and poetry and stuff like that, but it had just been in the kind of, you know, in the classroom. And when I went to university in Canada, I was very lucky to find a great teacher who kind of inspired the whole class. You know, everyone wanted to be Robert Browning. Everyone wanted to write poetry, essentially. And so I began to write poetry. I don't think I would have had that nerve if I'd stayed in England. You know, I think the new world, it really was a new world. You could begin and become a mountain climber or champion cyclist or poet even. You know.
So you came to Canada with no conscious desire to be a writer, to be a poet, or the other, all the other things that you have done?
No, not at all. I mean, I it was the furthest thing from my mind. You know, I wanted to read books. You know, I was a reader before I became a writer.
What did you like to read?
At that time, anything. I mean, it was. I didn't have any kind of plan. It wasn't kind of serious English fiction or anything like that. It was just thrillers, you know, some good books, I guess. But I can't remember what they were. And I'd never really read poetry before, so that was the great discovery for me. So, the first 10 years of my writing career was as a poet.
Did you surprise yourself with the fact that you could write?
I don't know. I suppose I did. I mean, I had no idea that people would be interested in this stuff, you know. I suddenly surprised my family. My mother was completely shocked. She kind of couldn't believe it. I mean, she, in fact, if anyone was a great inspirer, she was. Because I think what she did, I mean, she had a very rough life after her divorce, and she brought up the kids in London and, you know, had a very tough job. But she would always take us to theaters. You know, I mean, the second night I arrived in England, I was taken to a West End play, and you know, whenever she could grab tickets from someone, she'd take us to the theater, or she'd read books. And so that the fact of literature being a right and being not a kind of waste of time, I mean, that sense was, I think, the most important thing I got from my parents in a way.
You've said that the influences on you are things like music and painting and film, which seem very different. I mean, they're very fluid compared to writing, which, of course, is putting words on paper, mm-hmm. at least with music. It's notes on the page, but somehow it feels different. Mm-hmm. How do those influences work on you as a writer?
I don't think they're direct influences on me. I mean, I think I would, if I was going to talk about... They're the kind of influences on me that, say, smoking or swimming would be. You know, I mean, the way you swim, I think, affects maybe how you write. I'm not quite sure about that, but anyway. But, you know, I think music was important for me. And you know, I mean, I was always an avid film goer, and I was always like jazz and, you know, that kind of music. So all those things, I think, what I saw in them was more kind of how the different art forms kind of can teach you things. You know, not a film doesn't teach me how to write, but I think, you know, how... I mean, I've done a couple of documentary films, and having, you know, edited a film, I think filmmakers know how to edit much better than novelists often. You know, I mean, I think the actual precision of, you know, being able to play with 24 frames a second, you know, and time a kind of double take to that precision is something that if you kind of take over into fiction or nonfiction, you can be very useful to you, you know, to be really aware of when you cut and when you kind of, you know, end a scene. So in that sense, what one can learn technically from other art forms, whether it's, you know, film or whether it's in painting, and for me, someone like Diego Rivera was very important in terms of what he did with the mural, And in an earlier book of mine, In the Skin of a Lion, you know, that mural form became quite important to me. It's a kind of structural thing.
You won the Booker Prize for The English Patient, and this is, of course, a very prestigious prize. Does that make you a celebrity in Canada?
Yeah, it did. Or it does, I guess. It's in a way, it's made me a bit more public than I probably want to be. But you know, I guess that's you had to put, you know, give up that to a certain extent. But you know, I mean, one can also remain pretty private.
You've been called the Greta Garbo of Canada. Is that fit?
Well, I don't know. I mean, a couple of years, about 8 years earlier, I was called the Warren Zevon of Canadian writing. I mean, what
Which
does this
do
mean?
You want? I know.
I prefer Warren Zevon, actually.
I don't blame you. But you need privacy to write.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think what one does want to do is be turned into that cliche, you know, of the writer who is a good or bad or badly behaved or, you know, well behaved or whatever.
But if you're now famous, do people want you to say things, to make pronouncements about events?
That does happen, you know, and you always want, people want to kind of do, you know, various things, and some of which you're not quite happy to do. But, you know, in a way, it's you're also kind of worrying about the next thing, so. You know, the thing is you want to become go back to being a human being. No.
I'm still stuck on this Warren Zevon of Canada.
I know.
Did you ever figure that out?
No, I think I was writing, well, some of the earlier poetry was a bit kind of dark, you know. So I can see some slight parallel to Excitable Boy or something like that.
Do you like Warren Zevon?
Yeah, I haven't heard him very much lately, though.
As a writer, do you feel the power, the influence of American writers? Is it experience that way as a kind of en masse
writing? I think, well, you see, I think one of the problems about this whole business about being independent as a country culturally is that you have, we live right next door and you have the same language. And so you have every movie and every, book used to get much more, coverage. Not so much in books now. That's sort of reached a kind of sensible level. And I think also there's one's aware now that all the good literature does not come from just London or New York. It comes from all over the world. It comes from Australia and Africa and, Chile and so forth. So there's more of a sense that, sure, Norman Mailer is a good writer, but he's not that great a writer because, there are others who are, perhaps in Morocco who might be better, So there's that kind of sense of everyone being equal. But certainly something like film has, American film destroyed Canadian film to the point where all the movie houses are owned by American companies. So, that makes it difficult to kind of convince someone to show your movies if you've made one.
Is it clear to you what becomes a film, what becomes a poem, what becomes a novel? Whether it's an image, an idea?
I guess so now. I mean, I don't know what form it'll take, but, I know it'll be a short poem or a long piece, I know that. I know I make whether it goes into documentary or whether it goes into a fiction. It's something you discover later on, depending how much time you need to spend on it. How much it's more to do with time as opposed to what form it takes. But I mean, I one of the things I've always worked with in terms of whether it's a memoir like Running in the Family or a novel like The English Patient, is that sense of anything can enter this story. Anything can enter this book. You know, it may be a novel, but if I want to have 3 pages about dogs and how they walk and their musculature, okay, if I can fit it in, I'll fit it in. If I can get away with it, I'll put it in. So, I think I try and remain as open as I can.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Writer Michael Ondaatje, his latest novel, The English Patient, won the 1992 Booker Prize for Literature. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowain with Fresh Air. Chris Elliott, comic writer, actor, and son of Bob, says he wanted to carve out a niche for himself, and he has. On Late Night with David Letterman, he created characters like the panicky guy and the guy under the seats. On his sitcom, Get a Life, he was a 30-year-old paperboy living with his parents. The show was a cult hit. Now he's playing Nathaniel Mayweather, an overconfident idiot in the new movie, Cabin Boy. Coming up, we talk with Chris Elliott. And world music commentator Milo Miles reviews Pure Pleasure, the debut album by Shaggy, a Jamaican-born New Yorker who's into dancehall reggae. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Michigan Court of Appeals has taken up the state's ban against assisting a suicide. The law was written to stop Dr. Jack Kevorkian, who's been present at 20 suicides since 1990. But he's not the only Michigan resident interested in the outcome of the case. State Senator Fred Dillingham, who co-wrote the law, cares for a 20-year-old daughter who was severely handicapped. He's afraid people like his child will take their lives if the state says the law is unconstitutional. But Kevorkian supporter Marie DeFord says she's ready to help a friend who suffers from bone cancer to take her life if she wishes to. The law is being challenged by Kevorkian and the American Civil Liberties Union, which says the rule violates the right to self-determination. Interstate highways in and around the Pittsburgh area are finally clearing out after snow and ice caused massive traffic jams. Winter storms have made some roads impassable. From member station WDUQ, Christina Senko reports.
Travelers using Interstate 70 outside of Pittsburgh during rush hour found themselves stuck in a 25-mile-long traffic jam yesterday. Snow continued to fall on the roadways until the rush hour, making it difficult for big rigs to make the steep grade. So drivers just put the rigs in park, bringing all other traffic to a halt. The roads are still slick today, but Carol Finelli of Metro Traffic in Pittsburgh says the rigs have been cleared from I-70.
They started to pull out quite early this morning, and when it's before dawn. They've had crews working through the night with gurneys and tow trucks trying to yank these huge rigs off of the highway. It's been a haul.
Road crews could face another challenge tomorrow morning. Forecasters are calling for more snow, sleet, and freezing rain for the Pittsburgh area late tonight. For National Public Radio, I'm Christina Senko in Pittsburgh.
A UN spokesman in Sarajevo says people in central Bosnia are starving because relief aid convoys have been prevented from getting through. The BBC's Bob Simpson reports from Sarajevo.
The spokesman, Commander Van Biesbroek of the United Nations Protection Force, said the inhabitants of small villages in particular had been found starving in Muslim and Croat-held areas of central Bosnia. He singled out the mayor of Kakan for his special criticism, explaining that he had said that any food he controlled went first to soldiers, then to the families of men killed in action, then to the wounded. Ordinary civilians were way down the priority list. The United Nations refugee organizer in central Bosnia, Larry Hollingworth, who is in Sarajevo, admitted Kakan was a black hole as far as he was concerned. He explained the shortage of food by saying that last month he'd got in less than 20% of what had been judged the essential minimum. The bulk was simply not getting through because of interference with convoy traffic, he said, despite the Geneva Agreement to allow free passage.
Bob Simpson reporting. The Dow gained 5 points today to close at a record 3,803. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. In Togo, a possible assassination attempt against the West African country's longtime military leader was foiled at an army base in the capital, Lomé. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
At least 40 people were killed and scores injured during a guerrilla raid at the main army barracks in Togo's capital, Lomé. The apparent target of the attack was the residence of longtime military leader President Nasembe Eyadema. About 100 men armed with automatic weapons, rockets, and grenades tried to storm the base, but were turned back. Eyadema was not home during the attack. Defense Ministry spokesman said that 35 rebels were later captured. The Togolese government has ordered the country's borders sealed and imposed a dawn-to-dusk curfew as troops search for the remaining rebels. Meanwhile, Togo's government also announced that it had postponed parliamentary elections scheduled for later this month. Preparations for the voting had been lagging. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
The South African government says two men have been arrested in connection with the shooting deaths of four people in a crowded bar last week. The South African Law and Order Minister says the men are allegedly members of the Black Nationalist Azanian People's Army. That group is one of two that has claimed responsibility for the attack. Several gunmen opened fire on the bar, populated by students, on December 30th. Four people are now in custody in connection with the attack. The Clinton administration is getting ready to release its plan for the future of the U.S. airline industry. Officials say it suggests the Federal Aviation Administration be overhauled. Another proposal would relax restrictions against foreign ownership of U.S. airlines. But no airline tax cut is in the works. The White House says the plan is the biggest since the airlines were deregulated in 1978. The airline industry is already supporting an expected proposal to reassign air traffic control duties to a new government agency, and the Air Traffic and Transport Association says this could save billions. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Chris Elliott has been building his reputation by making a fool of himself. He began his career as a writer for Late Night with David Letterman, winning four Emmys. He developed a series of wacky and endearing characters for the show, including the panicky guy, the guy under the seats, the fugitive guy. Elliott's popularity on Letterman led to his own TV show called Get a Life. It was about the exploits of a 30-year-old paperboy who lives with his mother and father. The father was played by Elliott's real-life father, Bob Elliott, of Bob and Ray fame. Get a Life developed a small, fanatical following, but died after its second season. Elliott has had supporting roles in a number of movies, including The Abyss, New York Stories, and Groundhog Day. He now has his first chance at stardom with Cabin Boy, which opens on Friday. The film is about an insufferable rich kid who gets his just desserts when he mistakenly boards a fishing trawler called the Filthy Whore, thinking it's a cruise liner. The fishermen make him their cabin boy, enjoying the humiliating tasks they make him do. Among his many chores is being lookout as they navigate through a sea of icebergs.
Okay, you hit one.
Damn it! Tell us before we hit the bloody things!
Oh, now I get it. Sorry.
This little system's working out great.
I don't know exactly what this means, but a giant iceberg just winked at me.
Not a promising development.
Now, the character you play is Nathaniel Mayweather, a perfect name, of course. You describe him as an overconfident idiot.
Yeah.
Isn't this the
part
you've been...
I think I was describing myself at that point. Yeah, that's basically one way of describing him. He's sort of an outgrowth of the persona that I've developed throughout the years from Late Night to the TV show that I did. And he's kind of a guy who's just sort of has tunnel vision. He doesn't really see the rest of the world or care really how he deals with other people and deals with people on somewhat of a childish level, I suppose.
Does this require a lot of research on your part?
Well, you can tell just by talking to me, Marty. I'm pretty much that guy. No, I mean, it really is something that I've just sort of, thanks to Dave Letterman, just I was given a chance to do. But it definitely is a persona that I've been doing since high school.
Well, I have to tell you, there's a whole conversation going on the internet about you and this movie.
Uh-huh.
Everyone apparently on the internet is very excited about it.
Oh,
this
that's
is Chris Elliott's big chance. We have got to make sure this film is hot, or Chris Elliott may just remain a cult hero. These are your fans.
Oh, that's nice to hear. But, you know, I'd be happy with that. I you know, the idea of having a cult following to me is fantastic. And if somebody had said to me when I was 15 years old and already knew I wanted to go into this business that, well, don't worry, in 10 years you're going to have a cult following that will be fairly loyal to you, I would be ecstatic, would have been ecstatic, and I'm happy to have that now.
Is there a sequel to Cabin Boy?
A Boy 2?
Boy 2.
There is in my head, and I think that's probably where Disney would like me to keep it. I don't know. I think that's up to the money people and how it works out, and if it is popular or just a cult hit or whatever. But I think there's I have other movies in me with that go in other directions as well. So hopefully I'll do something else. I'm not, you know, the kind of guy that just thinks, okay, now I'm a movie star and I'm just going to do movies. You know, I really like doing television an awful lot. I like the real quick aspect of TV and being able to throw away what you do and go on to something else. So I may do some more in TV.
Well, do you see yourself playing a boy into your old age? A perpetual boy?
Well, I don't see myself playing a boy now. I know that he's sort of, people in the movie call him that, you know, cute kid or cabin boy in a sense. But he's probably, at least Nathaniel's probably about 30 years old, and he's a guy who's just sort of developed later in life than most kids, because he's been sheltered for so long. I think there will be this quality in everything that I always do, and I think there's a tradition in that in comedy. I mean, if you go back, you know, Laurel and Hardy were kind of kids, you know, the Marx Brothers certainly were just like, you know, children. So I think that thread will probably always be in my stuff.
Here's a personal question for you, but is it your chin, you think, that has kept you from stardom, real stardom?
My chin?
Yeah.
You mean my lack of? No, I think it's just my bad attitude.
You don't have a star's attitude?
No, I don't. I should, shouldn't I? I should throw more hissy fits. Maybe that'll get people to notice me a little bit more. No, I think I just because I am trying sort of in my own awkward, obnoxious way to sort of cut out my own niche in this business, and to a degree I've been successful doing that, and that's not unlike what my father did, as opposed to sort of playing the game the way the rules are supposedly written. But, you know, another reason is I don't consider myself an actor, so I don't go out and I don't compete for roles with other people my age or my type, because I give right away, I grant right away that there are billions of actors out there that are better actors than me. I just think I'm a funny guy, and I think that I'm best in things that are designed specifically for me.
Well, your dad is Bob Elliott. What did he teach you, if indeed you can use that word, about comedy, about humor?
He is very sarcastic and sort of looks at underlying qualities in people. And even in a lot of his characters, there's sort of subtle things subtle characteristics that he would latch onto in his characters. And as opposed to being very broad, and I think that that I got that from my dad, is just kind of looking at sort of the more shadow side of people that's funny. You know, for me, it translates to sort of the psychopathic side on people that I find funny. But that's not usually something that somebody would latch on to if they're trying to come up with a character.
Was he a funny father?
Funny as anyone else's dad. You know, he is a very normal guy who was on radio in New York City, where I was raised, and he left for work just like any other businessman. And he, when he came home, it was done with. It was not a Hollywood or showbiz family at all. That's the way I'm trying to live. Also, is just very unaffected by what I do for a living.
So you didn't tell the kids in the neighborhood that's my dad, Bob Elliott, on the radio?
No, not at all. I think I was impressed, though, as a kid. I remember walking down to his office with him many times, and just about every other block in New York City, somebody would come up and shake his hand and say how much they enjoyed him and how much joy he had brought into their lives. And even as a kid, I remember, you know, I guess early on just thinking, my dad, geez, he knows a lot of people in New York. And then once I realized what he did for a living, then I realized that was pretty neat.
Do people come up and shake your hand?
They come up and scream in my face, get off the air. Do us all a favor.
I can't believe that. Not having read the internet.
No, I have a very strong core following, and they do stop me a lot. It comes in waves, and television, I think even more than films, at least on the level that I'm doing films, is that kind of exposure is unbelievable. I mean, when I did this TV show called Get a Life, I had just been on really the Letterman show up until then, and 2 weeks into the show, I was just mobbed in playgrounds and by kids that were actually watching the show. And then when that show went off the air, then it kind of waned a little bit, you know, and that's when I hit the bottle pretty hard.
Well, I want to talk about Get a Life, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is Chris Elliott. His new movie is called Cabin Boy. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Chris Elliott, and his latest movie, which opens very soon, opens tomorrow, is called Cabin Boy. Well, I do have to count myself as one of the hundreds of your fans of Get
nice.
A Life.
Oh,
and there is a real hole in my TV watching schedule that it's not on the air. Why do you think it didn't catch on?
I think it did catch on, believe it or not. I mean, the ratings were never good, but, by people's response now, like yourself, I'm still stopped by people that say, you know, what happened? That was wonderful. And I think that it impressed people because it was different. It was a different show, and it was odd, and it was kind of odd to be scanning your TV channel and going from, Different Strokes, Full House, all these shows that kind of look and sound the same to something as bizarre as that and actually have it being offered by a network. Or almost a network, and I think that's why people remember it. Why it didn't catch on is sort of for the same reason. I think it scared a lot of people, including the network themselves. I think it was just so odd that even I look back on it with a great deal of embarrassment, along with pride. But I think it was just kind of a frightening, ugly show.
Well, we should explain the premise before we get too deep into it. It's about a 30-year-old paperboy named Chris Peterson who lives with his parents.
Right.
Where did this premise come from?
Well, I lived with my parents till I was 23, and there's a jump between 23 and 30, but I think that it probably the initial idea sort of stemmed from the fact that I did that, because I can remember sort of family gatherings where people, would kind of look at me like, when the hell is he going to get on with his life? And, I sort of latched onto that as a character. It was interesting, though, when the show was pitched to Fox, I don't think that they knew what they were going to get. I think they were hoping for more of a Peter Pan type character, a guy who's really a child at heart but says what he says is silly, but we find some wisdom in it. And
I don't know.
I think if you know my work at all, it's, what we were trying to do is basically a show about a nut. And that's what they got. And I think part of the reason it got pulled was because it wasn't really what they were hoping it would be.
Well, everybody has their favorite episode. Mine is Wallet Boy.
Yeah, that's a lot of people's favorite. That's interesting that you say that.
Describe the premise for that episode.
I guess the idea there was that I, for the first time in my life, go to the big city, which is sort of a mystical place, I guess, to me. I take a train and to the big city and go through these big doors and like Oz, and the city is then sort of vintage 1940s New York City, and I end up losing my wallet and become the local hero in the city, and all the fun that happens after that. But the idea for that sort of came from, I think I had seen Walter Mitty for the 100th time on television, or I was scanning through it, and I remember seeing the backdrops and the chroma key and the rear projection that they used in that movie, and I thought, well, that would be fun to do that as an episode if we could get some of that footage. And It actually was a hard thing to shoot, but it came out nice.
Well, after all the attention and all the hoopla about Wallet Boy, it turns out that Wallet Boy had left his wallet at home.
Right, yeah, yeah. Again, being kind of a stoop. Yeah, he sort of goes through the John Doe scenario of becoming the big hero, but then we find out that he was an idiot and he's expelled from the city.
Do you miss doing the show, or do you feel like you got away with it for two seasons and you're pretty lucky to be able to do that?
No, I don't miss doing Get a Life at all. I do miss doing television regularly, although I am going on Letterman every month with a little short film of my own making, and that's fun to do. Keeps my hand in TV.
Well, I thank you, Chris Elliott, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Oh, thanks, Marty. It's a pleasure. I appreciate it.
Chris Elliott's new movie is Cabin Boy. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about some of the stories they'll be covering today. Linda, what do you have for us?
Marty, as you know, Vice President Albert Gore made the speech on foreign policy that President Clinton planned to give. The president's mother died during the night, so he canceled his appearance. We will be covering that speech and the statements which are made in advance of the president's planned trips to Europe. Also on foreign policy, Anne Garrels has an interview today with the Secretary of State, Warren Christopher. We are also remembering Tip O'Neill today. We're visiting his neighborhood and talking about his leadership.
Linda, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. World music doesn't often have a solid chance at big commercial success, but world music commentator Milo Miles notes that reggae has been having a resurgence, and one of its most promising new performers is Shaggy. Milo says Shaggy can sing and rap dancehall reggae with enough personality to transcend novelty. Silver day, you know me, I'm a texture on a dread. Give me the 45, no bust, no corn, no bust, no lead. Lyrical entertainment when me give them instead. Silver, Mr. Shaggy, up in the conference. Sting and rubber, rough production again. When I wrap up, when I skin up, when I beg no friend. This one will be laughing, big y'all pick me them sing.
An eternal cliche in pop fashion is that everything old is new again. But that misses the point. What's being done to make the old new again is what counts. Right now, the performer doing the most brilliant job of reinventing the past is Shaggy, a Jamaican-born New Yorker who excels at dancehall reggae. Roughly speaking, dancehall reggae is the Jamaican response to hip-hop music and rap, which was itself influenced by Jamaican DJs who boasted and scatted over instrumental rhythm tracks. Dancehall got rolling in the mid-80s, and in general, it has not been well received by Bob Marley fans. Dancehall often neglects social commentary in favor of party-hardy anthems, and in a case of stars like Shabba Ranks, really ugly sexual hostility. Shaggy's double inspiration is to make his persona like an old-fashioned 60s Jamaican DJ and his rhythms avant-garde propulsive. His debut, Pure Pleasure, is the first single-artist dancehall album that amounts to more than a hot single or two. The single "O Carolina" was a smash in Europe and elsewhere, and while I don't believe in the predictive powers of foreign sales, remember the grim fate of the Lambada, "O Carolina" is a dandy little package. The song was originally recorded by the Folks Brothers in the early 1960s, but Shaggy knew it in a slightly later version by his obvious idol, the great Prince Buster. Prince Buster was a leading light of the style called ska, and a bit of a takeoff on James Brown and gangster movie Bad Guys. Like Buster, Shaggy comes on like a simple randy rascal. So numbers like Nice and Lovely, Love How Them Flex, and Lust show little of the anger and predatory attitude that spoils so much hardcore rap and dancehall.
She's me nice and lovely, yes, oh, she lovely, girl. She come to club me fancy, nice and lovely, but oh, she love me, girl. She come to club me fancy, hot and she buff, filthy and she rough. I want a young girl, she is my extra stuff. She is my ebony, she is my chocolate fudge. My hot chocolate, you know where she come fuzz. Where Raven and Shaggy Rasta knows every rough. I'm not the number one for make the world shake up. She's nice and lovely.
Shaggy is no ruffian rude boy. He's an ex-Marine who served in Desert Storm, so it's no surprise that by dancehall standards, he's a family values guy, and kind of patriarchal. He encourages abstinence for young virgins, says mom and dad deserve thanks and praise, and he even offers an equivocal argument for married love and fidelity in the song Lust. He succumbs to that sin pretty gleefully, though. Shaggy and his producer, Sting, who has no connection with the rock star, also do not conform to the fashionable cant that in order to be macho, dancehall guys have to avoid melody. He enjoys an unusually rich repertoire of vocal gymnastics, and the growls and groans and whispers and croons never seem to stop coming. Each track delivers a fine, fat hook and very cagey shifts in tone, from pure dancehall chant on Lust, to hipster saxophone cool on Nice and Lovely, to a smartly understated swipe of George Clinton's Atomic Dog on the song Bow Wow Wow.
Now I'm over there to call man dog, but I'm the original D-A-double-G, sweetest can be original pedigree, no tick, snuffly, dove, I'm in shaggy. Dog don't, you want no. Me ball.
Bow, wow, wow, E-B-O, E-B-A, bow, wow, E-B-O, E-B-A. Bow, wow, wow, E-B-O, E-B-A, bow, wow, E-B-O, E-B-A.
Some woman a call man dog, say man a take y'all for yous. No call me name if you no dung in a me shoes. Call a call man dog, say man a take y'all for yous. No call me name if you no dung in a me shoes. Call me human or better call me animal.
For once, a title like Pure Pleasure is simply descriptive. Any postmodern schlub can throw together styles from hither and yon. Shaggy has listened broadly and fused every manner and lick he needs for a delightful collection of songs both vivacious and audacious. Whatever period he sounds like, he's right on time.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. He reviewed Shaggy's new album, Pure Pleasure, on the Virgin label.
Well, everything we shanty do, all the people follow me. Everything when me a do, bossy them a follow me. Everything when me a do, the New York people follow me. Everything when me a do, London people follow me.
Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Joan Tuohy, and Naomi Person, with Nancy Greenlees and Sue Weinstein. For Terry Gross, I'm Artie Moscowane.
Them got on virgin, to they give them bow, wow, wow. Them a ton dog, do a grow, whiskers, deal, and a back like Scooby-Doo.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.